So I welcome you also on behalf of Oriol, who is the co-chair with me in this session. And we split our task up in such a way that I would be moderating through the session, and he will kindly support me with the technical support and also looking into the chat if there are any questions. We do have now left, instead of 90 minutes, 85 minutes, which still leaves us close to 12 minutes per presentation, including discussion. So please make sure you stop after 10 minutes so we can still have one or two questions after each presentation. And also please apologize, I will interrupt you if you go over time, because I think it's really important that every one of you has the same share of time to present his or her ideas. Then getting to the program, it's interesting, it's called Salutogenesis. Certainly, as you saw, some of the presentations are more explicitly related to Salutogenesis. Others probably more implicitly, by also focusing on resources and also more positive health outcomes, so very much in line with what we call a salutogenic orientation. Now I realize I never introduced myself. I'm actually Georg Bauer. I'm also chair of the Global Working Group of Salutogenesis and was also co-organizing this conference. Regarding now the seven presentations we do have, we have three really related more to what's healthcare in a broader sense, then three really related to the educational system, and then an additional one really around this important topic of traumatized women, how they really can survive and live well in future years. And the program is more or less also ordered in this themes as I presented it now. With that, I will stop my introduction and now immediately hand over to the first presentation by Claudia Meyer Magistretti, who is from the Lucerne University of Applied Sciences and Arts in Switzerland, and also a dear colleague in the Global Working Group of Salutogenesis. So Claudia, please go ahead. Oh, yeah, I'm still muted, Claudia.
Good morning, sorry. My presentation deals with promoting health for vulnerable mothers in the first years after childbirth. And this was the first Swiss study, actually, that threw light on early life care and education from the perspective of mothers and parents. The study was conducted by Lucerne University and University of Graz in Austria. Our research questions, now it doesn't move the screen. Yes, our research questions covered three areas of early childhood development: health, social inclusion, and education. For all these areas, we analyzed the accessibility and the use of services of early life care and education, as well as mothers' perception of the benefit of the use and the effect of the use of services on family and children's health. We investigated groups of families in different living conditions, and we followed about 500 families, one group middle and high income families, one families without migrant background in social welfare, and the third group was disadvantaged migrant families. We conducted a cohort study with two cohorts, baby cohort, when we first interviewed them, we interviewed them at home in personal interviews of 1 hour each. The first cohort was where babies, families had babies aged 0 to 2 years, and the second was the toddlers cohort with children a little bit older, and we interviewed them twice within the within 3 years. Data analysis was conducted with ANOVA repeated measures for quantitative and content analysis for qualitative data. You will now have in the whole presentation three colors: blue for the middle, middle income and middle education or high education population, orange for families in social welfare and gray for migrant families. This will be in all our graphs and figures the same. And you see here living conditions differ in terms of education, employment, financial resources, and consequently also in terms of main problems parents told us, which were lack of time and fatigue in general population, poor housing and social isolation by social welfare recipient families, and language problems and financial fear in migrant families. Amazingly, the resources were all the same. All families reported the same main resources they had, the family itself, the children, the partnership, and all the moments of love, trust, sense of belonging, and moments of happiness in the family. When we have a look at the access to services, we see that Switzerland is far away from universal coverage in early life healthcare. While we have high equity in prenatal care in the medical system and paid by health insurance, inequalities start immediately after birth. Families in social welfare, the orange below, have little access to postnatal midwifery home care, and only half of the migrant families use the counseling centers for early life care, even though both services are free of charge for all families in Switzerland. This is still related to the medical system. When we come to the educational system, things get worse. You see, one third only of the families has access to daycare centers, playgroups, and the most effective programs we have for vulnerable families are home visiting programs. And you see here, they are less than 10% use it, and it's the main population that uses it most. These inequalities have bigger risks for children in families, especially in families with high burden. As we see, they are different in the migrant family, where we find mainly low education, poor knowledge of local structures, and social deprivation. Whereas we find in the Swiss welfare family, a bunch of psychosocial problems, mental health, addiction, trauma, domestic violence, overload, poor self and self-organization, and which is really bad is handicaps or chronic conditions in both children and parents. The good news of the story is if parents use these services, they benefit. The benefits they reported were in the medical system, trust, and trustful relationship with professionals. They got the information they needed, and that this gave them a sensation of security. The educational support, work domain balance, and social contacts to other parents were most appreciated in the use of educational services. We also measured the outcome of health. We measured the sense of coherence, and we found statistically significant improvements in the disadvantaged families. And as you know, mother's sense of coherence has a huge impact on parents and children's long-term health and health behavior, and on important parenting qualities like competences or family cohesion and bonding. And they have a good impact on the development of the children themselves. A special quality and also a special challenge of this study was the very strong collaboration with the 9 cities we conducted the study in. And we worked together with the representatives of the early childcare and family departments in the city administrations. And this, they gave us research questions, they gave us access to the families, and in recompense, we worked out city profiles for them where they could accurately plan their new early childhood policies, which they did, and where they included us researchers as well. So The good thing about this is it was a difficult learning process, of course, always for both parts, politicians and as researchers. But it were the politicians themselves, the administration authorities themselves, who spread the results, and this had the effect that this study is part of the first policy paper we have in Switzerland by the Federal Council of Switzerland now, that sort of designs the policies of the coming years. These are only a few results of the study and a few conclusions we could draw. I named three of them. Key was to really go with the mother's view, to ask them what they want and what they perceive and what they have access to. We had the second new, the new result that Swiss low-income families are a new target group. We were not aware before this study that they have such poor access to services. And last but not least, the collaboration with the political administration facilitated and accelerated the implementation of research findings. And that's why the next study, we did a follow-up study of this one, was designed in the same way. You will find here the references, and I thank you for the attention.
Thanks a lot, Claudia, for this very, very interesting and I think challenging project you made, really getting close to the people and really understanding their perspective, and then also making this bridge towards the services improvement and even the policy level. I think that's quite impressive what you could accomplish. So now we do have time for two or three questions. Please go ahead. Audience, I mean, certainly. Maurice, welcome, please.
Claudia, thank you very much. Can you please comment on whether you think that one of the issues that are blocking the use of services are problems with trust of the system? If I'm thinking now about the migrants coming from perhaps situations where trust is not very high and not adjusting in that way. Could you say something about that?
Yes. Good. Concerning the migrants, it depends on the nationalities. It depends on, roughly said, how strong dictatorship was in the countries of origin. Then they are afraid. But we have now 13 years of programs, including inclusive programs for migrants, and those prove effect. And so the distrust and the fear is not this much. We have Eritreans who are very fearful, Somalians, people who are communities that are difficult to achieve, to contact, but it's getting better because of the program. What is worse is the social welfare families, because they are afraid their children are going to be taken away. That's why they do not use the midwives. Who would come at home. They all have access, they all have addresses, they just should make a phone call, but they don't do it because they fear, they see I'm addicted, they see I've got problems with my everyday life, and then they will take me the children away. Distrust and mistrust is a big, big problem, yes, right, and thank you for mentioning.
Thanks a lot. Do we have time for one more question?
Sorry, Claudia, is possible that there are differences or there are maybe more resources for the people who maybe needs less than this equity or it's similar, but maybe there are some group of families that they need less these resources, it could be?
Sorry, I'm afraid.
I could repeat the question.
Yes, please.
Yeah, there are more resources for that group of families that maybe they need less these resources, and maybe the individuals with less resources need more support for the government, and that could be.
Yes, this is true. It's only 10 or 15% of the families who really would need a closer support. And we are now, we're just finishing a follow-up study where we build up networks that are built on the trust to the medical system, and where we allocate personal counselors to the family, and the family says what the family needs and not the expert. And we are trying now this model of network in 3 areas of Switzerland. And we hope we will have some money, but in Switzerland, it's the regions who pay for early childcare and education and not the state. So this is the problem. We will have to have 23 initiatives.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot also for this last question and this again, very important contribution, Claudia. We would now move on to our second presentation, which is actually by Oriol, who just asked the last question. Oriol is from the Biomedical Research Institute in Girona. So actually we do have a home play here. And so we are very curious to hear about your project related also to the sense of currents in dementia camps.
Yeah, thank you, Jörg. This study is related with the variability of sense of coherence in dementia carers and its effect on burden report after 12 months follow-up.
Could you choose the presenter mode on the bottom, the big screen? On the very bottom, then we see the full slide.
It's not?
Yeah, this one, yeah.
Okay.
No, but we still don't see it. Just, yeah.
Okay, let me change again. Now?
Yeah, perfect. Thanks.
Okay. The full screen, yes?
Yeah, thank you.
Taking care of a family member with Alzheimer's disease is not easy. The progressive cognitive impairment associated with the Alzheimer's diagnosis causes increasing dependency, limits up an ever-changing situation for the family members and carers. The main survival time after the diagnosis of Alzheimer's could be close to 9 years. And you can see in the figure, although the differences between individuals exist, the trend of carers is reporting greater burden throughout the process. Sense of coherence could be defined as the ability to cope with daily stressors. In this case, caring could be a stressor. We know that the sense of coherence is an important modeling factor of burden report, and some coping strategies show a greater influence than others in this modulation of the burden. And the idea was to know if these modeling factors could longitudinal interpersonal variability of the sense of coherence influence of the burden report after 12 months of follow-up. This is a study, is part of a project, a Sock and Dem project, that is a 24-month follow-up study with patients with Alzheimer's disease and family members who is living in the community. The data of these studies, it's a baseline and 12 months of a sample of 135 carers. And then we have the sense of coherence with the 13 items orientation to life questionnaire. And then we analyze or assess the burden with the Zaryt scale. Now we have a cutoff point of overburden at 45 points. Then we build a new two variables after 1 year. The first one is the difference from baseline score to 12 months of the sense of coherence scale, and then we divided it in quartiles of evolution. The first one is the reduction, and the quartile 4 is the incrementation of sense of coherence. At the same time, the same of the burden report, we analyze the difference as incidence of overburden, persistence, or remission. This is the main age of the carers, close to 65 years old. No? most of them were women, and 57% of them was the partner of the person with dementia. The main score of the sense of coherence was 73.1 points. That's quite high, looking for the literature tool. And we can show that the number of cars with a high overburden or high burden expressed are close to 50% at baseline. And this figure increased after 12 months of follow-up, to 62.9% of cars express burden or overburden in after this 12 month overdose. This some group of the cars are remission, and most of them maintains the double burden. We show that the baseline sense of coherence shows a slight effect on the burden evolution. In this case, the beta is very slow and the reduction is not clinical significant. Looking for the differences between baseline and 12 months sense of coherence, we can see that the group there is not differences in the main group between baseline versus 12 month follow-up. When we can see, look for the differences between the burden evolution groups, we can see that the incidence group and the remission group show differences. The first one showed a greater sense of coherence at baseline, and the remission group showed a great sense of coherence or expressed better scores at 12 months. As a conclusion, we can see the CAS sense of coherence remains stable throughout the study. The evolution of burden report is mediated by sense of coherence. Incidence and remission of burden show a higher variability in sense of coherence specified by these CARs. And we thought that the impact of dementia could be different by individuals, but burden generally tends to increase higher in those with lower sense of coherence. And also, we saw that sense of coherence is not an invariable construct, but higher sense of coherence could facilitate better homeostasis when stress factors appear. This is the final idea, because we know that there are many previous studies and so show this stability in sense of coherence, but when they appear a new diagnosis or stress factor, like a dementia diagnosis in a family member, could be an important point to decrease this own self sense of coherence. But then the recuperation of that could be better if the previous one is higher. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks a lot, Oriol, for this interesting presentation. It really showed that it's always important to not look at the whole study population as a whole, but to really make this very meaningful and purposeful subgroup analysis you showed very well. So I'm really curious what the questions are now by the audience. Yes, Maurice, please.
Yes, of course I have a question. It's a very important study. Thank you so much for your presentation. I wonder if you could say some more more generally about this very positive development for some of these participants where the care burden decreased. And I know you addressed that, but I wonder if you could summarize your impressions about the most important factors behind a decrease in burden.
Yeah, it was the first idea, try to associate this remission or the reduction of the burden report with the sense of coherence, but it not appears significant in the model, but we show this difference in the first time and on baseline, and then a 12 month follow up. No, the sense of coherence differences between these groups. No, even the main group remains stable, the scores. No? And then we can say the remission group has a better score in terms of coherence at baseline or less in 12 months. We didn't find that.
Any other question? Hi. Yeah, Carol?
Yes, I've got a question. When you talk, I don't know if it's me that I didn't catch it, but how did you increment, or how did you try to increment the sense of coherence in the groups? I didn't. The group you were studying, you suppose that their sense of coherence it was incremented.
No, the sense of coherence remains stable from baseline to 12 months in the main group. But the incidence group, the group of incidence of overburden, right, showed a reduction of sense of coherence at 12 months. And then the remission group showed an increment of that. But the main group, all the cars, showed a similar sense of coherence.
Okay, but there was no actions taken to improve the sense of coherence of the group?
No.
That was the question. Thank you.
Okay, but then maybe I'm allowed to ask the last follow-up question, because that certainly also made me very curious. What would you think now, Oriel, after having done this study, what would be your strategies you would recommend to really help people to boost their sense of coherence in this very burdensome situation?
Yeah, in a previous study, we find some different strategies in self-esteem and self-awareness that improve the relationship of the center of coherence and burden report. No? Even center of coherence is a construct, it's not only a score. There are many other actions that we can do to improve this center of coherence to mediate the burden report. In this case, self-esteem, self-awareness of the relation, the situation, reduce a little bit the negative coping strategies, and improve the positive coping strategies. Also, if it's possible, increase the social support of the family, or reduce the isolation of the cars. It could be a short direct association with the sense of coherence that at the time reduce the burden report.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot. So really both strengthening personal strengths and also certainly improving the social environment, helping you to deal with the situation. Okay, so now we need to move on to the next presentation so that each presenter has a fair share of time. And we now move on to Oriel Tilore. She will talk about the salutogenic processes in the relationship between Zambian schools and the Norwegian teacher education. So with that, we now move to this additional topic of education. Oriel, please.
Can you see it now?
No, you still need to, the green button at the bottom.
Yes. Where can I find it now?
Normally at the bottom of your window of Zoom, you have this green button, sharing screen.
Yes, it should be, but I don't see it now. Maybe I will put this down and maybe I see it. No. This is my own.
This you is need to increase your window or something.
Yes, I know where it should be, but I don't get this one. Am I the last one to present?
No.
Maybe you should take another.
Okay, let's do that. And you can actually go.
I have your presentation if you want. I can pass.
Let's do it direct. Oriel, please go back to the main room and try to find a solution with the technical support in the main room. And if you don't manage, then we will take Oriel's suggestion and he will go for your PowerPoint, okay?
Okay.
So with that, hopefully Claudia is also ready to go now. So we will now take her presentation. Claudia Sardou, she's from the Department of Public Health in the University of Cagliari, and she will also speak about the educational sector, in her case, about triggering a salutogenic approach in Italian schools. Claudia, please.
Okay. Can you see my slide?
Yeah, you can also go on the presentation mode, please. Yeah, here. Perfect. Thanks.
Okay, perfect. Okay. Thanks for introducing me and good morning, everyone. In my presentation, I'll share with you some reflections coming from an experience made in a typical Italian school, where I and my colleagues from the University of Cagliari have tried to trigger a salutogenic approach. In Italy, the Ministry of Health emphasizes the importance of the school setting for the health promotion. And this topic is faced in the National Prevention Plan, that is the fundamental tool for health promotion intervention. It aims to promote both individual and collective health through actions that accompany citizens in all stages of their life, in the places where they live and they work. And each region must implement its own regional plan by shaping the context and objectives of the national plan within the local context. According to this framework, school is an ideal setting for health promotion, and a school that promotes health is committed to carry out actions that improve conditions of health and well-being of all its members. So we can say that from a formal point of view, the premise looks good. But what's about the reality? In Italy, mass media frequently report news highlight the growing discomfort in a school setting. So incidents of violence among students or toward teachers or bullying, increasing gaps in students' literacy, and also teachers' frustration with their salary and with their working conditions. In this context, in 2018, the Regional Prevention Plan set the actions and budget for health promotion in schools. And then the University of Cagliari was invited to give lectures to teachers and health professionals involved in the implementation of the established actions. And on that occasion, listening to the teachers, we had the impression that there was still a lot of work to be done to promote well-being in school. In fact, the characteristic of government funding for health promotion favor characteristics such as discontinuity of funding, pre-established topics, short-term deadlines favor a traditional health education approach that does not meet the health needs of school communities. Additionally, health education activities are mainly oriented towards students' health-related behavior with a specific focus on risky behavior. And with regard to teachers, teachers' well-being, only intervention for the prevention of burnout, so with a pathogenic approach, are occasionally carried out, while other stakeholders are not considered. We know from health promotion and salutogenesis that moving beyond this pathogenic approach could favor well-being in the everyday school context. So we wondered if can we do something. And we decided to make our health promotion skills available to a school for free of charge to try to go beyond this pathogenic approach. So, triggering a sustainable and replicable process for the development of a salutogenic approach in a school was our aim, while global health, empowerment, active participation, lack of dedicated funding, flexibility, and long-term outcomes were our keywords in our proposal. And the proposal included the three main steps. So first, the identification of expectations for well-being at school, then identification of needs and available assets for well-being, and finally, the activation of the change through the identified asset. university would have provided a methodological contribution, but all the details, so topic, aim, activities, have to be defined and implemented together with participants. At the end of December, the head of an institution that include preschool and several primary and secondary schools expressed interest in our proposal. So we presented our idea in a meeting with the teachers, and 20 teachers joined this initiative. These teachers were aware that students' well-being depends on teachers' well-being. And in fact, they decided to start the project with the teachers' well-being, because they said nobody cares of us. And in the slide, you can see some feedback to our proposal. We can see teachers liked the idea, but understanding that the project had to be built together was difficult for them, because it was an unusual process. Teacher expectations for their well-being were related to work with serenity, to be able to teach and learn in the everyday work, and to feel good in the classroom. In our work with the teacher, we performed some focus group that allowed us to obtain a map of unmet needs for teachers' well-being. Only the general categories are shown in the slide, but I'd like to emphasize that most of the needs are related with factors within the school, so are related with the relationship between teachers, relationship with students or with parents, and also with the timing of the different activity. Other aspects related to then external levels, such as recruitment policy, support teaching, time for certification of disability, were mentioned very few times. Then we performed through a brainstorming and a photo voice. We created a map of the assets that teachers recognize they have in the school setting for their well-being. And the structural, technological, and organizational assets were identified, as well as the opportunity to participate in community events, the personal resources like different skills among teachers, creativity, positive energy, and positive relationships among teachers when present were considered a resource. In the final meeting, teachers saw hanging on the walls of their school the needs and assets maps. And they were pleasantly surprised. And as they themselves point out, in that moment, they fully understood the significance, the meaning of the proposed experience. They said that we already knew the individual points, but seeing all the needs and the resources together make us acquire a different awareness of this situation. And in their analysis of this map, they highlight that the unmet needs for their well-being in the school everyday setting could be effectively addressed with assets already available in the school. But the problem was time, because they would need time during working hours to take care of these issues. And they begin to talk freely, and additional aspects emerged. And we learn that it's not so much a question of assets, but rather it's a problem is a biased approach to health promotion in school. In fact, the strategies for healthy school are defined and at a central level, national, regional level, with a top-down approach, and are implemented even if they do not overlap with the real priorities of a school. And also topics, activities, timetables depend on the central level. But where is the empowerment in this process? And according to teachers, our proposal, our salutogenic proposal, was intriguing, but at the same time, it was worrying because it was unstructured. And in fact, overcoming teachers' distrust, initial distrust, and their difficulty in being actors and not just spectators were the main challenges we had to face. We understand that the teacher I used to prepackage health promotion projects, but where is active participation? And finally, although teachers along with students are the most important stakeholder in the school setting, activity appears not focused on their real need, but around system need. A system that requires, in addition obviously to teaching, a demanding schedule of compulsory activity with a lot of bureaucracy. Teachers said that their timetable is overcrowded and that there is little room for flexibility, for freedom, also for understanding needs and try to satisfy them with the available assets. So where is well-being? Where is well-being? Sorry. And I would like to conclude my presentation quoting a sentence that Don Luigi Sturzo, an Italian prize, the politician, said more than 70 years ago. Two things are missing from the school in Italy, freedom and resources. But without freedom, the resources would be wasted, while with freedom, it would be possible to find the necessary resources. This sentence is still true. And so thank you for your attention.
Hey, thanks a lot, Claudia, for sharing this very deep insight, how challenging it is to do health promotion in Italian schools now, and how could it look a new way of doing so really in a much more empowering and participatory way. I found that this is really a very interesting model case study presented. Thanks a lot. So the floor again is open for questions. Maria.
Thank you. Thank you very much for presenting. I have one question about how you said that very much integrated are the systems needs in the healthy school approach, but that which at the same time disregards the personal needs or the real needs of the teachers and students. And I wondered, apart from giving them more freedom and autonomy, if you, in the discussion, there came up additional things where they thought it could be integrated better in the school.
Okay, in our experience, we understand that the problem, the big problem for promote well-being is really the absence of flexibility. Although teachers have many assets, also personal assets, creativity, positive energy, for them is really difficult to exploit this asset for their well-being. I can just say an example. These teachers told us that in their school, reported that in their school, there was an happiness referent. This may seem a very positive thing, happiness referent for teachers' well-being, students' well-being, but they said also that the activities organized by the teacher, the happiness reference for teachers' well-being, take place during weekends outside the working hours because there is no time during the working hours. And so this aspect obviously do not promote their well-being because outside the working hour they have other needs in their life. So the difficult from a formal point of view, there is a great attention to health promotion, to salutogenic process. If you read the official documents, words such as empowerment, active participation, well-being are present many times. But in the reality, we have the impression that these things do not have any room. So it's difficult. Also, if you have the assets, and they recognize to have the asset, available asset, for them it was difficult to use them in within this system.
Okay, thanks a lot. I would just need to make a short time check because as I see now here in the participants list, I don't think we have one of the speakers here. Is Annie Olve Bachmann from Switzerland here to present? No? So if not, then I don't need to make so much pressure on time, so we can then allow for actually one more question to Claudia. No one, then maybe I dare to ask a question. I think really very impressively showed again how health promotion really only works when you make things which are perceived individually, now in your case of teachers, are made visible as a collective thing. So it's not only me who is burdened by these different things, but you really also made this conclusion that this kind of shared mind map of what's really bothering teachers and what also could be potential solution was very powerful. So how could that help you to maybe also, because you said you want to make it an approach which can be replicated in other schools. So how would you go about really making it attractive to other schools to follow your path?
We would like to replicate this process in other schools, but before to try to do this, we have probably to make an advocacy actions, because I think that at central level should be understood that it's not possible to realize health promotion activities, salutogenic activities without this system change. Because, for example, teachers are never involved when the decisions are taken. So how their well-being can be promoted? Also, if you have a good idea and you want to propose it to the school, it's very difficult for them to participate because they are overcrowded by bureaucracy, by things that apparently are useful for their well-being. For example, courses on burnout. But my question is how a course on burnout can help teachers to overcome burnout. I don't understand this. Yeah. Okay. So I think that advocacy action is necessary.
So that you even get access to the school, as far as I understand, that they really could follow this approach. Because probably as soon as you have teachers on board, they probably will be excited about this approach, I'm sure. Okay, I mean, I just refer to Paolo, who actually in the webinar on salutogenesis, he made this great story of his community organizing effort in one of his, I think his home village even. And I think this story was so powerful. So if you could actually maybe even create a video of your project you did with this one school as a model project, where teachers would present how they experienced that, I think that personal experience could be very powerful to convey this story to others. Schools as an entry point to show what kind of difference it makes when you really let people express their voice and participate actively. Okay, any other last question? Okay, if not, then we move back to Orthild. I hope you could resolve the issue.
Thank you. I will try to. First, I take the share screen.
Okay.
So I'm sure that it's a... I see a lot. You see a lot that I see?
No.
No, share.
Yeah, now it's coming at least, but still we only, now we see your screen, I mean your desktop actually.
My desktop. I don't know why this happens. I got,
you need to choose the right window when you have sharing screen, when you have the option, which window you want to share, and where you would need to select the PowerPoint window.
So
you just need to go out again and then do it again.
Okay. And the desk cannot help me with this.
Well, you could just open, is it open now, your PowerPoint? Yeah, now it is. Now you can go on presentation mode. Hopefully that works.
But can you see it?
No, still not, because you shared your desktop, not the PowerPoint. Desktop.
Yes, and I can't, and I'm not able to move it to the other.
Then I suggest that Oriol, you will be so kind and share your screen.
Now it's in that.
Okay, now you can go ahead. The floor is yours, Oriol.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Okay. Thank you. Yes, I will.
You need to tell Oriol for the next slide.
This,
we will forward it.
Yes. Now I will start. My name is Audhild Løhre, and the co-authors are head teacher Kalusa from Livingston and Professor Larsen from Tromsø. Let me see if it. And nothing functions like it used to be.
No, no, Oriol is doing it for you. Audhild, you cannot control it.
Oriol, next slide, please. Can you hear me? Oh, yeah, thank you. So this is about the school collaboration between Norway and Zambia. It started in 2007. It's the Trolimo school collaboration. And up to now, it includes 6 local Zambian schools, 4 of them in Livingston. And these presentations, it's not this slide, it's the other, the first one back, but it's okay. This presentation concerns the 4 schools. Slide number 2, please. Yes, concerns 4 schools in Livingston and the interface between these schools and the Department of Teacher Education in Trondheim. So here you see in this slide, you see slide number 3, you see that this cooperation, it built on a very good platform. It is a platform of trust, because Norway and Zambia had a bilateral collaboration starting in 2000. And in this collaboration, the Zambian schools were involved, for instance, working with the HIV/AIDS education. And from the Norwegian side, Ola Mo was a central Norwegian in the cooperation. And let's look at what he says. International collaboration is always important and necessary. When you meet people in such a way that you almost develop a personal relationship, then something happens. Such meetings invite respect and you get a different attitude. And from the Zambian side, we have Stefania Maseka. She first worked in the interministerial cooperation from 2000, the bilateral one. And she was later in the Trolimo collaboration as a head teacher. And she said about Trolimo, the program we are running now came in because of mutual trust and the mutual relationship that we had developed. Both citations are from the Trolimo history. Please go to the next slide. Thank you. The aims is to present and discuss the development and function of support system for the pre-service teachers that we send to Zambia every year, except in the pandemic. We have used minutes from the meetings, personal observations, experiences, and the pre-service teaches us logs in the methods, starting with a deductive entry in the analysis and then sorting out themes. The next slide, please. This is the first structure that I will tell you about. Because a collaboration like this does not run only by itself. It has to be some machinery, and it has to be some oil in the machinery. And this is one of the structures. In 2007, when we had the first school, this school decided to appoint a coordinator to function between the head and the staff and the school, and the young Norwegians coming, and also professors coming from Trondheim. But after a while, they understood that the young Norwegians, they saw that some coordinators did more to help them than others. And the coordinators understood they had to do something. So when we came there next year, they worked at each school separately for about 10 years. And then something happened. Next time we came, they had decided to work as a team and told us, we have met before you come, we have planned, and we have decided what to do together with the Norwegians. Something we will do together with the whole group of 16 Norwegians, and other things we will do at the local school. So this is a bottom-up initiative. Next slide, please. We can go to the next slide. Thank you. Yes, and there is another structure that is also very important, because the first, go back, please. Number six, this one, please. Thank you. Yes, it is the network of class teachers I will tell you about. Because the first 10 years, we worked at each school separately. We met the head, the deputy head, and the class teachers. And we saw that it was not so easy for the class teachers to supervise the Norwegian students. I could tell you a lot about that, but not today. And then there was one of the head teachers. We had discussions, meetings with the head, and we told what we saw. And one of the heads said, maybe you should invite all the class teachers together, so they can talk together and exchange ideas. So we did that. Started in 2018. Yes, please, the next. So now we are here.
Yeah, just interrupt briefly. You only have 2 minutes left. I'm really sorry. So the two last
two minutes left. Yes, that's okay. Fine. Okay. 2 minutes left. Yes. So I have told you about the coordinators who made the team themselves. And we had this network coming from an idea in a meeting, where also the top leaders, educational leaders from the district office was there. Next, please. So what we have, it's a small complex intervention. I think we can say that. It's anchored both in the top, in the district office in Zambia, and in the dean in our organization, Department of Education. And we have the floor workers in the middle. And it's functioning better and better. Next, please. So we could see this, analyze this as a complex intervention. And most importantly, I think also we can, it's fine for us, fruitful for us to see it in the salutogenic framework, because as a next step, we can start to talk with the Zambian teachers about and use the words from this framework. We can also do some more research on this focus group, maybe, because there is a lot of resources in the Zambian class teachers, and the important thing for us is to make them use their resources in interactions with the Norwegian young pre-service teachers. Yes, next please. So we thought we would say thank you with this one. Sunset at waterfront and an optimistic way of seeing life with the Greece trees alive. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Ortild. I think this was also very impressive how you could bridge these two educational systems across different continents and make fair with fruitful collaboration. Unfortunately, we don't really have time to take any questions now because of his technical issues. Please, I mean, just contact Ortild. You know, we have this option in the platform with 101. It's where you can actually set up an appointment with Ortild to chat with him. Okay, with that, I would now like to move on to the next presentation by Aviat Tursinai about foregoing of health services during the corona lockdown. I hope you are here. Yes, I see you. Hi, Aviat. Welcome.
Do you see it? Yeah, okay. So thank you very much. My name is Professor Aviat Tursinai, and I'm gonna talk about foregoing of healthcare services among adults during the coronavirus lockdown. I'm gonna talk about implications of new consumptions and technology use patterns. It's a joint paper that was written by me and by Professor Perla Werner from the University of Haifa in Israel. Let's start with a very general spectrum regarding the coronavirus lockdown area in Israel during the first two months, March and April 2020, I'm sorry. And as you can see, the first 6 weeks of between March and until the middle of April were characterized by many restrictions in Israel, such as there was a restriction of 5,000 persons gathering band. Then we were asked to have a 100 person gathering band. Then schools were closed. Then we were told to have a 100 meter roaming limit, and then there was a travel ban. And then that was until the middle of April. As of that, there were some first easing of the lockdown, such as the streets front shops were opening. And by the end of April, all shops and other malls were opened. I'm gonna talk in my paper only about the first lockdown in Israel, because so far we had the three lockdowns, and I'm talking about only the first out of the three lockdowns. What are the goals of the study? We have two goals. The first is to determine whether the public had to forego any healthcare services which are covered by the national health insurance in Israel, and then to which healthcare services were foregone. as the COVID-19 virus was spread and the lockdown was imposed. This is the first goals. And then to examine the determinants of the use of the traditional healthcare services and the use of the online healthcare services as against the traditional. In general, in ordinary times, we know that for foregoing healthcare services as depending on the financial resources, due to how long a person has to wait for his services because of access limitations, because person's hardships and barriers, and because of many other reasons. But as you all know, last year we had a very, very extreme atmosphere. And what we want to see whether this extreme atmosphere caused to a different behavior in the people's health behavior and in the characteristics of foregoing healthcare services. How do we do that? We use the latitude study by conducting a telephone survey using a structured questionnaire. We had about 3,000 Jewish men and women age 40 and above in Israel, where the response rate was about 49%. And the main survey question was that between March and April 2020, did you forgo any of the following healthcare services at least once or more? And we had an additional questions such as background illnesses, the likelihood of the COVID infections, the fear of being infected from the COVID-19, demographic backgrounds, and other many statistical background characteristics. Before I'll start, I want to mention three limitations of the study. The first is the sample size. The second is the representative of that we conducted only for the Jewish populations because of very restriction that we had. And the third limitation that we didn't have information about patterns of consumption of private healthcare services. And in Israel, we know that there is a huge variety of health behavior between the private and the governmental health services in Israel. So let's start and see some results. If we want to see the need to consume health services during the lockdown period, you can see that people declared that about 60% of them declared that they need to consume family physicians. They need to consume any family physicians between the 1.5 months of the first lockdown in Israel. About 45% declared that they had to have any interaction with expert physicians in the community. 20% declared that they had to go to an outpatient clinic, and 60% had to go and to meet any paramedical expert. We decided to concentrate only with those who declared that they need to use one of these four major healthcare services, because these are the most relevant and the most extreme healthcare services that people had to use during that period. And what we wanted to see whether people really forgone these healthcare services, or maybe these people didn't really use these services. So what we found, when we ask about the pattern of consumption of and foregoing of healthcare services between the people of these four healthcare services, when we know that people declare that they had to use these services, we see that it relates with the family physicians. People say that about a half say that they didn't forgo these services, and about 6% say that they didn't forgo these services, but they used an alternative, which means that they use a virtual visit by phone or by video. A very similar pattern was found in relates with the specialist physicians in the community, as well as with the outpatient clinic. But in regards with the paramedical experts, we found that a less percent was found in regards with the foregone healthcare, with the didn't foregone for healthcare services, while many people use the alternative of the virtual visits. But on the other hand, we found that many people did forgo these healthcare services. We found that about 34% did forgo any family physician interactions in this time period. We found that about 37% of the people declared that they needed to meet any specialist and they didn't go to meet the specialist, as well as the outpatient clinic, as well as their paramedical experts. And as you can see, many people say that they did forgo these healthcare services, both because they might afraid, and we'll see that in a moment in the model, but some of them declared that they did forgo it because the clinic canceled the visit, which is a very different reasons, which was they didn't decide it, but the clinic decided for themselves. In general, we found that about a half of the people, about 50%, didn't forgo healthcare services. 31% of them didn't at all forgo the healthcare services, one of the four. 90% didn't forgo the services but used an alternative, which is the phone or the video. And I want to mention you that it was only last year when many people used the phone and the video only for the first time in their year, in their lifetime. And right, about half of the people did
excuse need me, just use 1 minute more.
I'm sorry?
1 minute more.
1 minute, wow. I'm sorry, okay. Yeah. And you see that many people forwent their services. So in order to proceed, we made a model to explain why did people did decide to forgo. We used a very familiar model where we ask about three factors, the predisposing factors, such as the gender, the age, and marital status, the enabling factors, such as the income, the private health insurance, and the need factors, such as the need factors is their health behavior, their chronic disease illnesses, as well as their health atmosphere. I understand that I don't have enough time, but what we found that there is a huge difference between those who, when we look about the probability to consume healthcare services, both in the regular use as well as the virtual use, we found that there is a huge difference in the factors that's explaining why did people decided to use the regular use as versus the virtual use. When we found that the age decreases the probability of regular use, while decreases also the virtual use. While in addition, we found that the fear of being infected from the COVID caused a huge decrease in the probability that people will use both in the regular use as well as in the virtual use. While in opposite, we found that people who are very wealthy, people with a high income, used mostly the regular use, the services, while those who are rich didn't use that services. On the other hand, we found that...
Sorry, I need to interrupt. I'm sorry, okay. You fully used your time and we okay. really need some time left for Hildur. But I think you really made very clear the point that also in this COVID situation, certainly the social problematic, but disadvantaged people have less access, I think is also coming out here. And also the big challenge, how you can reach particularly the elderly who cannot really just replace healthcare online, regular healthcare by healthcare online, I think is a big challenge for the future. So thanks again for your great contribution. And again, audience, please directly contact Aviat via the one-on-one tool in the platform. With that, can we stop sharing the screen and move on to our last speaker, which is Hildur Gunnarsdottir. She's also part of our global working group of Salutogenesis and works at the Department of Health Sciences at the University of West Sweden. And I leave it up to you to introduce the title of the presentation.
Well, now all these buttons to push. Do you see my full screen presentation
Perfect.
Now?
Thank
okay,
you.
Thank you, thank you. Thank you, Georg, for the introduction. The study I'm going to present is a qualitative study with the title To Live, Not Only Survive, an ongoing endeavor about the resilience of adult Swedish women abused of children. The study is done in collaboration with colleagues from the University of Gothenburg and Örebro University in Sweden. It is estimated that about 16% of children in high-income countries have been exposed to some kind of physical, sexual, or emotional maltreatment or abuse during their childhood. And girls or women are overrepresented to all kinds of intrafamilial violence. All types of childhood maltreatment can have devastating consequences for health and well-being, both in childhood and adulthood, it's well known. But not all children who experience maltreatment experience negative consequences to the same extent. Some adapt positively despite these severe adversities. They develop and display resilience. And shortly, resilience can be defined as the capacity to recover from difficult life events. Previously mainly considered a personal trait, but nowadays it is rather considered a dynamic process that embraces individual interactions with their surroundings. Resilience has mainly been studied among children and youth, while only few studies have investigated resilient processes and resources related to adulthood. And thus the aim of our study was to explore experiences of resilience among adult women in Sweden. Women who defined themselves as well-being and well-functioning despite being exposed to any kind of maltreatment by a close adult during their childhood were enlisted from the general population through public advert and included in the study. The study is a part of a larger project called AWARE, about the women abused as children, their resilience and life experiences, hosted by the University of Gothenburg. But in this study, totally 22 women were individually interviewed. We used an explorative qualitative approach, and the analysis was guided by constructivist grounded theory. I'm trying to speak very fast. As a main result, we found that the core process of resilience was an ongoing endeavor to live and not only survive. Surviving referred to the basic needs and managing duties of everyday life, while living refers to the right to experience joy and to not letting these adverse experiences define one's life or well-being. The resilience process was found to be without a defined beginning or an end, as this can be illustrated by this quote. It has been a fairly long process, something that continues to evolve all the time. This endeavor was found to rest on four types of resources or driving forces, which we named and illustrate with these cogwheels, and we labeled them establishing and maintaining command of life, employing personal resources, surrounding oneself by valuable people, and reaching acceptance. And it was clear that these driving forces or resources, they did enable each other. And thus we can conceptualize the process by this machinery, interrelated parts of a machinery that drive the process of resilience, as we have tried to illustrate in this figure. Command of life could be established and maintained by processing the childhood experiences and managing feelings through dialogue, both with others, like close friends, family, or professionals, but also with oneself through self-reflections, writing letters or notes. Putting experiences and feelings into words was described healing. One woman said, the more I talk about it, the more understanding and distance I get to what it was like. It does not define me as a person today, but I carry it with me, I do, and always will. Oh, sorry. It was too early. How can I back? Oh, okay. I'll just jump on to this one. Employing personal resources was an important part of the ongoing endeavor, both the innate resources and also those acquired throughout the life course. Personal resources included the ability to embrace the joy of life, the possibilities to release the inner strength, and also to allocate the responsibilities for experiences and situations, both in the past and in the present, to whom they belong. To achieve well-being and a well-functioning life, it was important that the women clarified for themselves that the responsibilities for the abuse always belong to the perpetrator, but it also was obvious that the responsibility to go on with life and to convert the negative experiences to something useful was their own. As one woman illustrated in this quote, it's all about like getting oneself out of this. And that is not done by just sitting and feeling sorry for oneself. I also have a responsibility. I have to get a hold of my life. The next one, surrounding oneself with valuable people, consisted of two dimensions. One describing the importance of opening up for being cared for by others, and the other one describing the importance of taking care of others. Being cared for by others embraced the importance of supportive relationships, both intimate relationships and relationships with professionals and others outside the woman's immediate social circle. Taking care of others embraced the value of being responsible for the well-being of others, often own children, which in hard times could make the life worth living. One woman described the importance of her child health care nurse for her own resilience process. She said that she kept calling me to meetings anyway. She wouldn't give up. And then after a year, she got me start talking. So I mean, for me, it was a salvation that she understood. She was the only one who had seen and had understood. The last driving process is that the process of reaching acceptance was enabled by consenting the present, which was to include one's own, included accepting one's strengths and weaknesses and embracing the perception of being good enough no matter what. And realizing also that life naturally includes challenges that should be met with humility and serenity. One woman expressed it like this. You have to allow yourself to be sad and think that things are shitty, because sometimes it is. It is really shitty, but you have to remember, even when it is at its worst, that it will get better again. It will be brighter again. And attempt to understand or find explanations to why their parents treated them the way they did, but also a part of reaching acceptance. And the explanation and understanding of the parents' actions sometimes could lead to forgiveness, since, as one woman put it, you can love a parent at the same time you hate him. So, in conclusion, we found that the resilience was found to be an ongoing process that rests on both intrapersonal and interpersonal resources. And the process was also found partly to depend on the life circumstances and available resources for the women. So women are not born either resilient or not. It is to be considered an ongoing process. And of course, no child should ever be maltreated, but it happens whether we like it or not. And thus, women that have been maltreated as children, they must be identified at early ages and ensured possibilities to process their experiences, to make own life choices and get possibilities to release their inner strength so they will be able to live their lives and not only survive. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Hildo, for sharing this very, I think, sensitive study you did, really digging deep into his feelings and strategies with women apply to this very difficult, overcoming these difficult experiences. And I think it's really a very rich picture you were drawing in your presentation. So thanks a lot for sharing that. I certainly know that time normally would be over, but I think it would be more than fair to also give some minutes to Hildo for some questions.
Claudia?
May I ask a question? Yes, sure. Thank you. This is a very important study, and not only in Norway, I hope we will soon have accessible publication. Thank you indeed. You mentioned being cared by others was important. Can you tell a bit more who these others were? Were they professionals, psychotherapists? Were there more friends or peers? What did they tell you? What kind of support by whom was helpful for them?
Yeah, it was, of course, it was very different and independent, but it was, a large proportion of the women described the importance of their intimate relationship, that they had found some life partner they really, really trusted and could share the everyday life and their experiences. But also it was very clear that processing the experiences with friends, with family, with professionals and different kinds of professionals. And what I was made kind of impression on me was that we have to think broad. We can't think that everybody needs the same. It's not one kind of a therapy or one kind of a professional every woman should meet. It was so various what kind of a person. For some, as in the example, it was the child healthcare nurses he met with her own child that became her starting point. And they described the physiotherapists, and they described the name the psychologists, and some only used their personal relationship. So open up and availability of being able to process the experiences is the important, I think.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Any more questions to Hildo? May I ask you, Hilda, because I'm always this kind of intervention-oriented person, also in my own research. I mean, you now brought together this very rich picture, and I assume not all women probably have been able to develop all the strategies equally, I assume. There probably were quite big differences across the women you interviewed, or would you say all could develop that more or less equally? And if so, what could support other women in also developing this rich set of resources?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can certainly not say that every woman describes every of these driving forces, but everybody describes some of them, and most of them more than one. And it was kind of clear that they were they interacted. And yeah, what should other women do? I think this the mostly don't put the lock on, open up, and be and for the kind of authorities, we need to be open and we need to see these women and early. Many of these women, they described kind of a destructive periods of their life before they came into this functioning machinery of resilience. So for no one, it was just a straightforward process. So we really, really need to open our eyes and dare to ask. And yeah, we can't close. Yeah. If that's an answer.
Okay. Yes, absolutely. Thanks a lot. Any other last question?
Sorry. Yeah. Did you find differences in the resilience strategies in by the age of the woman?
We included adult women. So we said the youngest woman, I think, was like 32 years old, and the oldest one, 61, if I remember. But since it is a qualitative study with only 22 women, you can't make any conclusions or categorization based on age. And I can't say that we identified anything like that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so I think we should close now because lunch break is also important for our recovery. I really would like to thank, first of all, certainly the presenters for this rich insights in their studies. And I also found this combination of really more qualitative and quantitative research, some it's more focusing on single case studies. I found it very enriching and complementary. And I think, again, we learned a lot about how to really approach people, involve people, and really make their own perspective relevant for our field, because we can learn most by listening well to people, both through qualitative and quantitative data. And I think this was really very well presented in this session. And I thank also certainly the audience for the nice questions and discussions we had. And for now, I wish you a very well recovery during the lunch break, and see you hopefully next days in our Salutogenesis Genesis conference. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. It was excellent.
Thanks.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Okay.
Bye. Bye. Thank you. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Thank you all.